Virgin Mini, and delegates and guests of the Convention of the American Federation of Labor. I can assure you that it is a very great pleasure to me that you have given me this chance to come and talk with you about the work which we are trying to do in Washington for the peace and security of the United States. As I said to your reception committee, which met me at the airport a few minutes ago, I feel almost embarrassed to come and talk to a group like this about foreign affairs, because you've worked so long, so thoroughly in this field, that I think that you know more about it than most of us in government. It is indeed indispensable that an organization like yours should have engaged itself in foreign policy and foreign affairs to the extent that you have. You've done an amazing job in that field. And if you hadn't done that, I can say without hesitation that today the chances of peace would not be nearly as good as they are. Nor would we have the good fighting chance that we have to preserve values which are even more important than peace itself. You and your leaders have been in this battle where the struggle has been most intense, and you've gained an experience and a wisdom, and you have possibilities of action which indispensably supplement those of government. Now, as I've suggested, I would much rather listen here than talk, as I listened to President Meany a few days ago when he was good enough to stop and talk with me in Washington after he'd come back from Europe. I'm going to have a chance, I hope, at luncheon with some of your leaders to do some listening. However, since you've asked me during this period to talk, I shall do the best that I can. And I will first of all try to give you an estimate of some of the critical problems with which your government is actively dealing at this time. And after I finish that first part of my talk, then I want to go on and talk about some of the more basic overall problems of how to rout the communist menace. And that's an area where the workers of America can play a principal role. Korea was a matter of first concern. The armistice negotiations, which had been going on for a year and a half, had come to a standstill, and the fighting was going on, taking a steady toll of the lives of American soldiers and of others under the United Nations command. And there was growing a public demand that something had to be done, and that unless an honorable armistice had been achieved, that the fighting should be enlarged. We did achieve an armistice. The future, naturally, is still obscure, but at least the fighting has stopped, the aggression ended. Most of our men who were prisoners have been returned, about 3,600, and we shall do all that is humanly possible to ensure that all are returned. A political conference is, as you know, in prospect, designed to turn the armistice into a permanent peace. That political conference supposedly was to have been convened before the 28th of October. At the moment, the Chinese communists seem to be pursuing tactics of delay. I've been witnessing that at the United Nations, which I just left day before yesterday. But we believe that with steadfastness on our side, we can still bring that political conference into existence, and that there is a good chance that stable peace will come out of it. I can pledge you that we shall do all that we can to assure this. And I'm glad to say that in this matter, now our allies are united with us. And at this session of the United Nations, which began 10 days ago, we presented a united front. In Indochina, the war still goes on. And there's been danger that the resistance to communist aggression there would collapse, with resultant jeopardy to our vital interests in the Western Pacific. Many of the people of Indochina had been persuaded that their choice was between colonialism and communism. And a choice between two forms of subjection never gives rise to much enthusiasm or to much willingness to sacrifice and to die. But now the French, by their declaration of the 3rd of July last, have made clear their intention to grant full independence to the Associated States of Indochina as these states desire it. And the French are in process of implementing that declaration now in consultation with the states concerned. And there is every evidence that they are doing so, that the French are doing so in complete good faith. And so now the character of the war becomes transformed. The United States can now in good conscience contribute substantially in money and material to the successful conclusion of this war, which has now become more truly a war of independence. And if the communists, Chinese communists, pursue this war under present circumstances, the aggressive character of their operation will be fully and starkly exposed. Let me speak of Iran. In the Middle East, it seemed that Iran might become the gateway for a Soviet communist seizure of the world's largest oil reserves. Reserves which provide a livelihood to several Middle Eastern and Near Eastern states, and which help to sustain the air, the naval, and the land defenses of the Mediterranean and of Western Europe. But the people of Iran, who have learned a good deal from living next door to Russian ambitions, the people of Iran rose up loyally to the Shah to prevent the illegal retention of power by a regime which was becoming increasingly identified with the Communist Party in Iran. And now there will be a new opportunity for Iran to tackle its internal problems and to strengthen its ties with the other free nations. In Europe, the program for a European community had bogged down. And that result carried with it the continuance of the ancient division between France and Germany, out of which in the past wars have so often come. But now the plans for European unity are moving ahead. There has been a ratification of the European Defense Community Treaty by both houses in Germany and by one house in the Netherlands, and parliamentary proceedings in the other nations involved are imminent. I cannot, in good conscience, say to you that a positive result is yet assured, but surely the prospects today are brighter than ever before. The political victory of Chancellor Adenauer increases the stature and influence of a statesman who, in his international thinking, thinks not in terms of a nationalist Germany, but in terms of the long-range welfare of a Europe which includes a democratic Germany. The results of that election involved a spectacular endorsement of the policies which the United States has pursued, jointly with its Western allies and with the West German Republic. A sharp contrast is provided by what has been going on in the Soviet zone of East Germany. Last June, there spontaneously occurred widespread protest demonstrations. The only means of free expression that the peoples there could seize upon, which showed to the whole world the opposition of the peoples to oppression and their demand for free elections, for decent standards of living, and for the unification of Germany and freedom. East Germany's working people, the very people who, according to communist propaganda, were supposed to be the favored group, were the very ones who started the demonstrations. The United States government is trying to bring about a four-power meeting to satisfy the aspirations of the German people for unification. The British, the French, and ourselves sent to the Soviet Union an invitation to a four-power meeting of foreign ministers, which we proposed to be held October 15th. We sent that invitation on September 2nd, and the invitation still remains unanswered. But we still are hopeful that there may be an affirmative reply. We've been trying in some measure to alleviate the physical suffering of the East Germans through a food program for Berlin, which you're very familiar with. And President Eisenhower, just yesterday, I think it was, asked the American people to help out with clothing for the people of East Germany during the coming winter. A problem which has given us perhaps the gravest concern of all is the problem of new weapons. The forces of destruction, largely expressed in terms of atom and hydrogen bombs, are being developed on such an appalling scale, with ever-increasing scope of destructive power, that their existence threatens the survival of civilization as we know it. And furthermore, the possibility of setting these destructive forces into motion may be possessed by rulers who, as communists, openly repudiate the restraints of moral law. That combination is an ultimate in peril which mankind has never had to face before. What do we do? Well, there are some things that we don't do. The response is not to cringe. The response is not to become panicky. What the situation calls for is a hardening of our resolve to dispose of the present wars and of the present causes of war, and to move on into a system where we can have an effective control of these means of destruction. Now, these things are easier to talk about than they are to do. But the American people, in fact, the human race, is today so situated that only by strength of will, by clarity of mind, and by sustaining faith can we save ourselves and all humanity from self-destruction. Therefore, we must invoke, in the greatest possible measure, these qualities that are needed for our salvation. Your government, as I suggest, does not believe that salvation can be won merely by making concessions which enhance the power and increase the arrogance of those who have already extended their rule over one-third of the human race. We do believe that if our purposes are honorable, if we understand the just aspirations of other peoples, if we set forth reasonable positions so clearly that others will not miscalculate, if we are good craftsmen in carrying out our aims, then it is still our abiding faith that a just and durable peace is obtainable. At the United Nations last week, in opening the so-called general debate, I set forth the overall policies of the United States, particularly in relation to the Soviet Union. That position of the United States is clear. We are willing, more than willing, we are eager to deal with each of the principal situations which cause international tension, such situations as that of Germany, Austria, Korea, Indochina, and the burden of armament. And also in these matters, we are not inflexible. We claim no monopoly of wisdom or of virtue. We recognize that we can learn from others, and we are prepared to do so. We appeal to the Soviet government to meet us in an effort both to control armament and to eliminate the situations which might bring that armament into operation. 4 days after I spoke, last Monday, the head of the Soviet delegation replied, but to our great disappointment, what he said consisted merely of a repetition of the old refrains, bits picked out of prior speeches running back to 1946. It was nothing whatever that was new or hopeful. But, as we said there in the United Nations, we shall not grow weary, nor shall we allow ourselves to be discouraged in our quest for peace. Before passing on to what I referred to as a second phase of my remarks here, I want to point out that in our handling of foreign affairs, to which I referred, there has been bipartisan cooperation between the executive and the Congress. And I want here to reassert my dedication to the bipartisan approach insofar as relates to foreign policy. I've been practicing that for a good many years. In fact, I've been practicing it ever since I worked with Woodrow Wilson. The United States can only be successfully served by foreign policies which command the support of the American people generally and of their representatives of both parties in the Congress of the United States. Now I come on to the second phase, which is relates not so much to the official tasks of government as it does to a type of work in which all citizens can take part. And that is a task of making our American society so sound and so wholesome that it, rather than communism, will attract the admiration and the following of the workers of the world. And in that task, your organization and other like-minded organizations can help and do help mightily in our quest for peace. The Bolshevik communists are perpetrating, or trying to perpetrate, what in non-diplomatic language is called a swindle. They try to portray a workers' paradise and to get control of the workers of many lands as being the workers' friend. And it is a matter for serious concern that it is primarily by such methods that the communism has made its enormous gains. Since 1939, the Bolshevik communists have extended their grip over some 600 million additional people of some 15 other countries. In no case has this come about through the peaceful, voluntary choice of the peoples concerned. But the coercion that was applied was in no case the coercion of open military conquest, although in some cases the fear of that was a potent influence. The actual method of operation has been primarily to seize political power from within. Sometimes that has been done by civil war. Sometimes it has been done by a sudden political stroke. But in all cases, their success was largely due to the fact that the communists had previously won positions of control in what they commonly refer to as mass organizations. And I don't have to tell you that one of their primary targets is, of course, the labor unions. The professional communist agitators, largely working in secret, have sought to persuade the dissatisfied workers that a communist government would greatly improve their lot. The demonstrated capacity of communism to extend its sway by this falsehood is a dangerous fact. It means that the United States might be encircled, penetrated, and perhaps even overcome without the Soviets ever having to fight us in open battle. And indeed, Stalin often boasted that our defeat would come about precisely in that way. No task is more important than that of exploding the communist myth. That surely should be possible. Indeed, you in your worldwide efforts have proved that it is possible. And as President Meany, I think, pointed out, what happened in East Germany is certainly a big step toward a dramatic explosion of the myth of a communist paradise. The facts of what actually exists behind the Iron Curtain, those facts are all in our favor. The Russian worker is the most underpaid, overworked person in any modern industrial state. He is the most managed, checked, spied on, and unrepresented worker in the world today. He has, yes, full employment because the prison camps see to that. He earns his pay through a piecework system which would make the authors of the Taylor-Bideau system gape with envy. Legally, the Russian worker is not allowed to leave his job and to shift to another job because he is bound to his job by his labor book, and that is his only pass to future work. In Moscow, the capital and the show place of communism, the average worker's apartment has 12 persons living in it. The average living space per worker is about 6 feet by 7. Whole families must live in one room, and they share a bath and a kitchen with 3 or 4 other families in adjacent rooms. Prices are so high that for most workers, only bare existence can be paid for. I obtained some figures, and I hesitated about using them here because I know that the story is a very familiar one to most of you. Indeed, I think it's quite probable that the data upon which my figures are based may have been obtained in large part through your organization. But the figures are so striking that even at the risk of repeating what you already know, I'd like to give these figures. For a worker to buy a pound of butter in New York, it takes 27 minutes of work. For a similar worker in Moscow, it takes over 6 hours of work. For a pound of sugar, 3 1/3 minutes in New York, 84 minutes in Moscow. For a quart of milk, 7 minutes in New York, 42 minutes in Moscow. For a dozen eggs, 25 minutes in New York, nearly 3 hours in Moscow. For a cotton shirt, 1 hour in New York, 22 hours in Moscow. For a man's suit, 3 days in New York, 47 days in Moscow. For overshoes, 1 day in New York, 13 days in Moscow. For a woman's wool suit, 22 hours in New York, 22 days in Moscow. For a cake of soap, 3 minutes in New York, 30 minutes in Moscow. Some classes in Russia, such as the party leaders, factory bosses, secret police leaders, and ballet dancers, get well paid, and they live well. In the misnamed classless society of communism, there are the most extreme class distinctions. And in the hierarchy of class, the working man and the farmer are crowded close to the bottom. Statistics such as those which I have used are not, I may say, easy to get. You don't get them from official sources of the Soviet Union. The Soviet government maintains fantastic secrecy over even the most basic data in the field of labor. What's the average wage of the Russian worker? You can search Soviet sources in vain to get the answer. What's the trend of Russian cost of living? Soviet government hasn't published a cost of living index for 2 decades. The fact of secrecy really speaks most eloquently. If the Soviet government were not afraid of what the true figures would show, you can be sure that it would publish them. Only by secrecy is the communist myth maintained. I saw in New York this week the United Nations report on forced labor, which is going to be presented for consideration to the Assembly this fall. And as you may know, your Federation played a large part in bringing it about that this report should be made. The authors of that report are 3 eminent and independent personalities from India, Norway, and Peru. The report says that the Soviet Union and its satellites used the forced labor of convicts on a vast scale. It points out, and I quote, whole groups of persons are obligated by order of public authorities to take up or remain in a given job against their will if necessary, and may be penalized for not doing so. The report calls the Soviet methods of training and allocating manpower, quote, a system of forced or compulsory labor. And why do not the labor unions of Russia do something to improve these conditions? The answer, as you of course know, is that the communist union is simply the largest company union that there is in the world. The company there is the totalitarian state. Now here's a statement I read to you. Trade unions, which by nature are designed to safeguard workers' rights, have become, in fact, the organs of official communist control and oppression. Membership is obligatory. Meetings are rubber stamps for resolutions dictated from above, and objections cannot conceivably be raised. In short, the trade union is a mechanism for exacting the greatest amount of labor out of the worker. That statement was given to me day before yesterday by Dr. Marek Karowicz, who came to the United Nations as a member of the communist delegation of Poland and who took that chance to seek asylum in a land of freedom. This tragedy that has befallen the Russians should not perhaps surprise us. Rulers who invoke violence, hatred, and falsehood to win their ends usually reproduce the very conditions which they set out to destroy. The extremely violent character of the Bolshevik movement destroyed not only the reactionary czarist elements within Russia, but also the moderate elements. And so, in the end, the revolution has largely reproduced for the workers the conditions which prevailed under the czars. Much lip service is given to the worker. A few exhibits are created for foreign consumption, but that is where the worker's paradise ends. The rest is misery. It's a tragic thing that this fate should have befallen the Russian people. The Russian people possess fine qualities which we admire. They have always had the friendship of the American people, and today they deserve also our deep sympathy. The history of the United States tells a different story. Our social progress has been achieved by peaceful change. The political institutions with which our founders endowed us are flexible. So as our people have gradually gained clearer perceptions of right and of wrong, those perceptions could be translated into laws and into practice by orderly methods. Under that system, social and economic changes that have occurred in this country have really been immense. Human beings have less and less been treated as mere tools of production. There has been developing here an increasing sense of social responsibility. No longer can the social order be described as each for himself and the devil take the hindmost. Social security has rapidly expanded in scope. Graduated income and inheritance taxes bring about a very considerable distribution in accordance with need. Average hours of labor have steadily been reduced, and hours of leisure correspondingly increased. Wages, not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of effective purchasing power, have tended to increase. This has been possible primarily by cooperation between labor, management, and capital to use the inventive capacity of a free society to improve steadily the tools and means of production. Now, I do not pretend that the situation is perfect, and you know well that it is not perfect. Injustices and inequalities remain. There are still those who are underprivileged. Intolerance and bigotry still survive. And these defects we naturally emphasize as we strive here at home for ever better things. But from the standpoint of foreign relations, the status which has been won for the workers of America is a tremendous asset. What the communists pretend, we do. We Americans, when we face the outer world, can do so proudly. The facts about the communist world and the facts about the American world ought to be known throughout all the world. And if they were, then the communist menace would recede. Then Soviet power, which uses communism as a Trojan horse, would go back to where it belongs, that is, Russia. And in Russia itself, despotism would relax its grip and freedom would be reborn. As it is today, the Communist Party still holds control of many labor unions throughout the free world. In France and Italy, the largest labor unions are still communist dominated. In many other free countries, the communists dominate labor unions, which have special power in relation to transportation and the key defense activities. I know that this persisting influence of communism is a matter of great concern to the free labor unions, and that you of the American Federation of Labor are taking the lead in combating this situation. Also, I know that the world situation would be far worse than I portray it if it had not been for your timely and vigorous engagement in the struggle for freedom. You have done more than any other single body to explode the communist myth. And in this matter, there should be a more intimate partnership between us. You have not always received the official support and the backing that you deserve. I recall very vividly one incident that I would mention to you here. It occurred at the first meeting of the United Nations Assembly in London in January 946. And at that time, the Soviet delegation to the United Nations was trying to bring the communist-dominated World Federation of Trade Unions, to bring it into the United Nations itself and into other political conferences as the official spokesman of all the workers of the world. And at that moment, it was, as I very clearly recall, it was the representatives of the American Federation of Labor who played the major part in circumventing that plot. And then you went on to create the International Confederation of Free Trades Unions as an alternative to the Communist Federation. And that free trade union has performed a great service for the free trade unions of 73 lands. I have cited out of my recollection one example of your effort. The total chapter of your effort is long and it is honorable. Here at home, you have striven with much success to make the American record one of which all of us can be proud. And also, you have vigorously and successfully combated the communist menace in foreign fronts. In so doing, you have made a great contribution both to the glory of America and to the safety of America. Over our past, the most dependable defense of our country has been the goodwill created abroad by what was known throughout the world as the Great American Experiment. That was no military experiment, for during that period we had virtually no military establishment. It was a demonstration of what a free society could do in terms of political and social progress. Today we do have a great military establishment, and I'm sorry to say we need it. But it would be disastrous if we made the mistake of looking upon armed might as an all-sufficient defense. The greatest asset of our nation has always been, is today, and always will be, not military force, but this same great American experiment, an experiment in which the free labor movement plays the essential role of a dynamic force. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sure
that the rapt attention